Todd, say hello and welcome. You're listening to the voices of our people on the Wind Speaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker Trombley and see God soon. On today's episode, I continue my conversation with Manning, Alberta's Dakota House. Talk about the moments that led you to be inspired to get into the world of film industry and the first phone call you got that got you into your career. And of course, we'll get deeper into the parts of North of 60.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's really a Cinderella story. So, of course, being Indigenous and facing all this adversity and hearing no, no, no. You hear no so many times that it's almost a given, right? So you get sort of locked into this headspace until you could shake it off. But when I was 17 years old, my thoughts then were, okay, I'm 17, I'm almost 18, what am I going to do with my life? I really started thinking about that and what I wanted to pursue, and that's reiterating, I was going to join the Army, and that was my thing. I was, had a background in martial arts. I knew my way around the bush. I was good with the guns. I was a great shot. So I thought I was going to join the Army, and that was going to be my career. Thanks to my mom, she's the one who was responsible for it all. She saw this ad in the paper, and they were looking for young Native actors and models. Of course, I had no experience in either of the field, aside from playing Santa Claus in grade two, but that wasn't going to make me a star. But what happened was she shows me this ad, and it's looking for actors and models, 14 years old, and I was 17. My mom's like, hey, look at this, and I'm like, Mom, they're looking for a 14-year-old. I'm 17. At that time, I mean, I must have looked like I was 10. But I reluctantly gave them a call, and I was expecting no. So I give them a call, and I'm like, hi, I'm this age, and I hear you're looking for. And they're like, yeah, great. Come on down. And I was kind of shocked. Excuse me? They're like, yeah, come on down. Here's our address. They gave me the address. I went down. It was a cattle call audition. So a cattle call means they put it out to general public, and anyone who sees the ad or, you know, is interested can call them up, and they could go down and audition. I went down, I did an audition, and I got a call back. Little did I know that when you do get a call back, that means that they're interested in you. So I went for my second audition. For my second audition, they were super interested, and that's when I got offered an acting scholarship. So I took the acting scholarship, and it was a 10-week crash course. And I was probably one of two Indigenous people in the class. There was 20 of us, and I was the only one to make it. So going through the class, I mean, my classes were every Friday at 7 o'clock. And of course, a lot of people, when they hear Friday, 7 o'clock, one thing comes to mind, and for me, it was no different. You know, every Friday, I'd go over to my cousin's place across the street and ask who wanted to come to acting classes. I would always get laughed at. They say I would be wasting my time. I would never be an actor, that I was going to be that one in the background. And you know what? I believed in myself, and I thought, even if I don't make it as an actor, I'll still have the experience that nobody else has. So I kept going. And it was my second last class, which was life-changing. Because in the story, I don't share too much, but I think it's important that that I put it out there and that we do hear, you know, some of these, let's call it divine intervention, some of these things that happen where, if you're not listening, you might not hear it at all. So here I am, second last class, and walking to my class, and it started playing over and over in my head. You know, I had subjected myself to this constant, you know, every Friday is constant non-belief system of my so-called friends and, you know, cousins and stuff. And pretty soon I started thinking, maybe they're right. Maybe I am missing out. And, of course, we all know that I wasn't missing out on anything, because every Friday when I would go and say, hey, who wants to come to acting class? And they would tell me that I was, you know, that I was missing out and I would never make it. And my response was, okay, well, you guys will be here when I get back. 30 years later, they're still there. Every time I get back, I just don't go visit anymore. I don't got time for that. Anyway, going to my acting class, I stop. I'm thinking about it. I turn around to go get on the bus to go back to the party. No word of a lie, over my head, a loud booming voice says, "You're a bum." Now, there's nobody on the street. It's in an industrial area. All the lights are off and all the buildings around me. I'm the only one on the street. It's so quiet, I could hear my heart pounding in my chest, because with the chip on my shoulder and being a young kid like that and, you know, all the adversity and the struggles that I have faced, I'm standing there. And as soon as I hear that loud booming voice over my head, the first thing I do is I kneel down, I pick up a rock, I stand up, and I'm scouring every window looking, searching for a curtain to move, a light to flicker, anything that would indicate that someone's there, that someone yelled that at me. And I must have stood there for 10 minutes, motionless, looking, searching for anything and nothing. I dropped the rock, I started walking backwards, and I went to my acting class. Yeah, my instructor, yeah, she reamed me out. She's like, "Dakota, if you don't want to be here, there's 100 other people who are waiting to take your position." Back in those days, to hear that, any kind of stuff like that, I'd just turn around and walk. But I took it, I sucked it up, I sat there, and I worked even harder for that class and the next class. After my second class was over, boom, I was the only one in my class to make it. I got the call, and I landed my first show. It was not just handed to me, but there was a lot of work. There was a lot of emotional and mental breakdown from my own so-called friends and family. But when I made it, you know, I just didn't make it for me. I made it for all my young brothers and sisters all over the country. I made it for everyone who ever thought about wanting to get into the industry. I made it for everyone who, you know, whose dream was and whose fire was just starting to burn out. And being Indigenous, man, I made it for all of our people. And you know, still doing it today, here and there, of course, because most of my stuff is going miles.
And we'll get to the miles program later on, but I have to ask as well, is you know, in your acting career, you got your big break when you got offered the job and landing the role in North of 60, where you played Trevor TV Tenya. Can you talk about that day where you got that call that said, "Hey Dakota, we want you to be part of North of 60"? Talk about that process and talk about your time being in that series.
Oh my goodness, that was a boy. Actually, North to 60. That was my third audition. So my first audition after the scholarship was an MOW, a movie of the week called Diviners. That was a book that Margaret Lawrence wrote, a Canadian author, and I landed the role on that show of Jules Tonnerre, who was Tom Jackson's younger version. Right after I did that show, Thomas King, who's another Canadian Indigenous author who wrote a book called Medicine River, so I auditioned for that, and I landed that. So two MOWs back-to-back, and then I auditioned for this character TV on a new TV series called North of 60. So the day of the audition, it was a hot summer day. My hair was dyed black from the previous movies. I slicked my hair back. I put on a tank top. And I had that bad boy look going on. And I went in. I auditioned for this character. And felt pretty good. I got a call back. That was a reading with Lori Okamau, who played Bertha on North of 60, his significant other. And then I think it was about a week later, I got a phone call, and it was the casting director. And she says, "Hi, is Dakota there?" And I'm like, "Speaking." She goes, "Oh, sorry, maybe I shouldn't be calling you Dakota anymore. Maybe I should be calling you TV. You got the role." Holy cow. I just like, "Mom!" Yelled out to my mom, and oh my God, I'm like, "I got it. I got this." So it was life changing. Went down to, got my first script, and everything was so new to me already, you know. I mean, here I only did two movies of the week, and then I land this a principal character in a TV series, and absolutely life changing. Being part of an ensemble that was, history making. Really, there was not a TV series, anything out there that was related to or dealt with Indigenous issues or in a small community. And these were issues that everyone from every walk of life could relate to, and they understood. And what we were doing was we were portraying an actual community in the Northwest Territories that people were tuning into every week. When I first started doing the character TV, I would start reading my scripts from back to front instead of back to front, because I always wanted to see if my character got lost in the bush or drowned in the river. I always thought he was going to be written out because he was such a just such a badass. Yeah. But it was funny because everyone could relate to that character. Not only could everyone relate to, I could relate to this character that I was playing. He was, boy, so similar to me in so many ways, like the adversity and the struggles that he went through in life. And, you know, watching TV and seeing things on TV, being in the small community and trying to act like some of these characters that he was seeing on TV. I mean, of course, his name was Trevor Victor, so that's why they called him TV. But TV also was, a direct nickname to him, always watching, you know, TV and being how he was. So I think from landing the role on North of 60 and really kicking open the doors, you know, there was people who I looked up to, like Tom Jackson and Graham Greene and, you know, Tina Keeper and, oh man, Art Hindle, and all Canadian actors. And the first three were the ones who were on they were all on the show, but they also played in numerous other shows all over. So I really had an opportunity to learn from some of the pros who had the experience and seniority.
That was Dakota House from Manning, Alberta. You're listening to the voices of our people on the Wind Speaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker Tremblay. Next, I continue my conversation with Stoney Dakota First Nations Teresa Snow. Well, you're a judge for those pageantries and for the dances and stuff like that. When you get the call to do that role, what comes to mind when you get that call? And also, when you're there in person, what's that experience like to look at all the dancers in front of you, to focus on their, are you focusing on their stepping, what they're wearing as their regalia? What are some things that you do in that role particularly?
Yeah, that's a lot. And it comes from, I guess, lived experience or experience being in the powwow circle and going to powwows and being a dancer, being a competitor, but also learning and becoming a parent and having your kids dance and seeing both sides, being a dancer and understanding the roles and responsibilities, but then also becoming a judge and understanding those roles and responsibilities. And so I've had a lot of different experiences in which to base things on. And again, with the intention to look at the teachings of the dance or how the footwork is being done and the song. Is the song appropriate for the dancers? Do we need another song? Or what are the conditions that the dancer is dancing in? Is it a hard cement floor? Is it outside? And then with pageant, what are we judging them on? Is it a traditional teaching? Is there knowledge of their outfit? Is it their education? What are their aspirations? And a lot of different things coming about, but always just happy and blessed to have the opportunity to share knowledge and to learn as well too, because we don't just learn from others that are older from us. We learn from the youth, we learn from the children, we learn from experiences that we have maybe with one person for 5 minutes and them talking and sharing a story with us that will follow us for our lifetime, that will guide us over our lifetime. And so it's always been about I was once told when I was in Shakopee at the we're there traveling, and my mentor, my supervisor at the time, they told me, everyone you meet is a contact, and so always be gracious with them and thankful for them and what they teach you or what they show you, whether it be negative or positive. That's always a teaching to keep with you, and be mindful, because everyone you meet is a contact. And so everywhere I've gone, when I meet people, whether it's from someone in a high position or someone working as the janitor or whoever, I try to say hello to everybody and be pleasant to them and understand that they're all doing a role that they're gifted with, and have that same approach and to learn from them too. And then in the pageants, judging that, like being asked, my friend kept asking me if I was coming to the pageant or to the powwow, and I was like, no, I don't think so. And then finally she said, I need a Canadian judge. Can you come down? I know you've gone to pageants. You've been in pageants. You've gone to powwows. You know, and I need a Canadian judge, and you would fit this because you've been a princess. You've had that role. You know what it requires. But also, too, you have education about the teaching and the dance and the dresses. And so I'd like you to be the Canadian judge. And so I was like, oh, okay, then sure, I can do that. So then I went down, and I hadn't danced in a long time. I was I stopped dancing in 99 when my son passed. I was at a powwow and he passed away. And then 2007, I was reinitiated into the powwow circle. And I didn't have my outfit. I wore one of my mentors, Irene, I wore her outfit, and she danced me back in. And so then after that, I start working on my outfit, getting it together, getting the beads, the plumes, the feathers, everything ready for it. And then the opportunity came up to go to Vegas and go to the powwow. And I thought, this is so cool to have a powwow during INFR and be asked to come down and judge. And I thought, well, if I'm going to go to a powwow down there and it's the first ever, why don't I dance? And so then I worked on my outfit, and my nephew and his wife were really supportive. They've always been supportive of me dancing and the artwork I do as well with my family, but they really encouraged me to dance. And so then when I went down to Vegas, I ended up dancing there for the first time in a long time. And for me, it was really cool, because it was taking care of me and my self-care, because I hadn't danced for so long. And like I said, growing up, I was always used to going to powwows, and I loved dancing and being a part of that. And so going back into the circle and people seeing me, but being in the circle and hearing the songs and being able to dance, that was really fulfilling to me in that aspect. And so, yeah, I think we all come to healing in different ways in our lives, whether it's through dance, music, artwork, being on the land, creating different things. It's just whatever your passion is and leads you into that role of fulfilling your dream.
Because with all the things that you've done, you've also done a lot of, you've received a lot of education in your time as well. You know, you hold a criminology diploma from MRU back from 1994, relating to the domestic and family violence, parenting and trauma training, and also your skill at program inception and curriculum development, where you have assisted in creating programs for Indigenous communities. And now when you have done that for many Indigenous communities that are in need of those services, how did that feel to create those services accessible for families within those Indigenous communities?
I think within working within it, understanding that it's not a generic template, and every group, every community is going to be unique based on a few different things, and that's their area that they live in, the land resources, if there's water around, if there's mountains around, if it's trees, what is their land resource at the area? And what is the history to that land? Like, is there traditional herbs that they use, sacred sites that they practice, that they go to or that they're able to go to? And then also, too, what is the history with settler history coming in, and what is the impact or rate of colonialism and imperialism, and how much has it affected the community in what they're able to do? And understanding, too, the spirituality of the community. Are they mostly traditional ceremonial people, or are they, do they follow religion? Is what is the faith in that community? And then look at the historical impacts. Was there a residential school nearby? What was the impact with 60 Scoop, with the Métis Nation? How have they been affected with it? Are they nearby? Was there a group? Was there a settlement nearby? And what is the nearest town, the urban setting to them, and how has that affected it? Because when we look at our Indigenous communities, we're often around cities or towns, and we give a lot to that, to maintain that livelihood of that town or that city, because we're constantly going there and buying food or clothing or getting our cars fixed or whatever. Because when you essentially look at reserves, they're deserts. They're a reserve desert. They have next to nothing for clothing-wise, for stores, for food. You do have a convenience store there, and the prices are often higher. And look at the quality of food in there. It's often soft drinks and chips. There's not really a lot of vegetables or food that are good for the body. And so then we have to look at that and understand, what is the needs assessment in the community? Is there a lot of opioid use? Has there been a lot of suicides? What are there nearby treatment centers? We don't have a lot of communities that have treatment centers on the reserve or long-term aftercare programs, recovery programs. And so what is the healing capacity of the community to take care of their people or meet their needs? And not only that, who in the community is working there? Is it a majority of Indigenous people from the band working there who have the training and the skill and the know-how? Because we're our best indicators of our healing. We know what helps us in our healing, and we can set forth that dream, that goal of what we're going to do of that programming. But if we have others that come in with their own perspective and their own ideas of saviorhood, that really affects our ability to help our people. And so when I'm asked to go in, I look at all these things and ask these questions. Well, what's working? What's not? And then I try to work with them with their needs assessment on what is needed in the community. And what I've seen, like, since the pandemic is we need huge amounts of grief and loss workshops for communities. We cannot expect people to get right back to employment and job employment because of the life skills that are needed. That's needed as well, too, life skills. But a majority of is grief, loss, and trauma. Because if we look at our communities today, we're going through so much continual grief and loss. There's a funeral one week, there's another the next week. We never have time to grieve that loss. And so I just see an onset of communities needing to do this for the next probably 5 years continuously. Every month, maybe you'll get 10 people, maybe the next month 20, maybe 3 the next month. But if you continuously offer these workshops or these programming for communities, you'll start to have that ripple effect, because we know everything's connected. We know everybody in a community is related. And so it's just trying to work through the needs assessment of what the community has and how it's unique. And one model does not work for another community because it's so different and distinct. And two, with language, we have to have that language in there as a part of the assessment. And so that's what I try to do when I go into communities. And it's basically creating a program for them that their workers can have, that their staff can have. And if it's facilitating or designing a program, helping them do that, to take it on their own. And in one sense, it may be working myself out of employment or a job to keep going to that community. But to me, it's strengthening that community and making them more viable and strong for their community members and their staff to have that encouragement to enhance their skills and to enhance their spirit so that they can work with their people and be the helpers in their community.
You were selected to be the Alberta representative for the Working Group for the Healing Fund, which is connected with the United Church of Canada, which grants organizations monetary contributions, scholarships for Indigenous students. When you were called up and you were asked to fill in that role, and they said, "Teresa, we want you to do this role," what was the first thought that came to mind when that phone call came to you in 2021?
The opportunity to do that, and a blessing, because to be able to come in with cultural knowledge and knowledge from working in various communities and seeing what's working and what's not working, and then to be able to sit on a committee and look at these organizations, First Nations, individuals, agencies, submit proposals, and how is it working within their community? What do they want to see? What are the goals they have for their community? And having a national perspective of it, to make it so that it's for everybody nationally that can apply. So someone in BC or Saskatchewan, and to make sure that we're being equitable about how we do the funding and what things are working. And is it something that's proactive for the community, and where is it going? And then always trying to be that of the understanding that, how will this help the community? How will this impact the community? If I was in the community, how would this be for me? Or is this something that would fit? Or is this a great idea? And there's been really good proposals that have come through that are amazing, and that we've been able to fund them. And so I'm still on the committee. I still sit on the committee. We just met in Winnipeg in April. And so just understanding, it's a collective way for organizations, for communities to come about healing. It isn't for individual gain to do these things, the funding. It's to do it in a community with the group or with the organization. So if they're doing something like a youth camp, then that's what we want to help with. If it's doing a language study with the youth and elders, if it's doing button blanket making, if it's all these things that are healing and cultural for people, then I think it's really good, because the church is stepping up and helping to do these things and fund these things that for many years they outlawed or that they were against. And so it's an opportunity for the church to make right of what was taken away. And what better way than to fund communities to help get these things started for healing or these activities.
Now, Teresa, you know, you're so, I have to say this from a personal note, from everything that I've heard, from everything that I've seen that you presented to me, that you've done within your life, you're truly inspirational. And with all the things that you've done, especially within your travels as well, you know, that you've done in your travels, you've also gone on to create new programming from an inspiration from your travels. And you created the Trainer of the Trainer program, Strengthening Your Camps, which is based with Indigenous communities to build distinctive foundational curricula, training, and workshops based on their needs, assessment, social challenges, and goals. Now, what was the inspiration in your travels to come up with a program like that for Indigenous students to take part in?
I think it was to reinvest in our community, because as I traveled to communities and with my own experience, I saw that we had many, many non-Indigenous members in our community getting trained and then leaving the community and taking that training with them. And that was a loss for us because the nation was paying for that training and it was being lost. And so as too well, I saw the dynamic of our people dealing with that intergenerational trauma, doing their healing and doing the work and becoming helpers in the community and not having the ability to enhance the training in an Indigenous collective way. And so when I was going to communities, there were certain themes that came up and certain areas that I thought could be improved upon or enhanced. And so then I thought, well, if every community is like a camp or a village, then we need to strengthen that community. So I called it strengthening our camps because it's basically strengthening the supports for our workers, giving them more skills, whether it's facilitation skills or documentation or counseling skills or programs, and then understanding the dynamics of how grief and loss and trauma are part of addictions, are part of child welfare, are part of family violence, are part of education, and how everything is interconnected, and providing a tool that's an Indigenous tool for it that comes from Indigenous thinking, Indigenous knowledge systems. And so basically I was creating a document that work within Indigenous communities because we all have unique knowledge systems that we often are forced to fit into a Western diagram or a Western box. And we think in a circle and we can't fit that circle into there because it's so dynamic and so interconnected. And so, and when we're trying to fit an Indigenous model into a Western one, we're essentially saying that that Western model is the forefront or the key or the standard. And we, as Indigenous people, we have our own Indigenous knowledge systems, language systems, kinship systems, mentoring systems that are unique and that work for our people. So why do we continue to try and fit it within a Western model? And so strengthening our camp is, it's a way of decolonizing that Western thought systems and processes and doing it within an Indigenous lens and a holistic way of looking at things.
And of course, Teresa, I have to ask, because with everything that you've done over the course of many years, what would you say the one thing that out of all the things that you've done, would you want to do again? Like that you could just, if you could relive it, what would that one moment be?
Oh, that's so hard to choose. I think just being in a circle with a feast with my family and talking, or with relatives or community, because I think that's like the heart of a community is when you come together and have a feast or talk together and just hearing those stories and how they're so profound and all the teachings and all the stories I've heard, and like that those people felt safe enough to share them with me, but also they taught me a lot about humility or teachings or protocol or compassion and forgiveness. And so I think within that and being within a circular, in a circle setting with whether it's family or community, and being able to, I think, know that this is providing some sort of pathway for my grandkids. And I think that's what, when I think about things that I do now, how is this going to affect my family or my grandkids in 10 years or 15 years? Am I providing a pathway for them to walk and be proud and strong and confident in what they do? Am I doing the things necessary now to have that approach? And a lot of things I've stepped back on doing because, too, we have to have that self-care. We're so used to doing everything for everybody else, but understanding my goals and what I want, and not what I want, but what helps my spirit and what supports me in that, if that's my family or my husband really supporting me and going back to school, or the work I do and coming with me and helping and teaching me a lot too about the medicines and the processes and different practices, whether it's ceremony or schooling or education. And like, we have a lot of good talks about things. And I think that's when you're in that environment, you're loved and supported, you can live your passion, you can do your passion. And like, we just went up to the Yukon the other week for training that I was doing. And it was really good because we always wanted to go there. And so we actually got to go up there. And so again, that's like living your passion, that we were passionate about being up north. And then we got a trip up there, which was work. And that was beautiful to have that. And so I think when we look at things and what we really love, it's again, that passion and what brings you close together with your community and family. And me, that's just having a circle with my family, eating with them, talking with them, laughing, catching up, because we don't have enough of that nowadays. We have so much, life is so fast now. And if we think back to our ancestors, they just did things as time happened. When they'd hear the thunder, when the berries would come out, all these things they followed with like a winter count. And we don't really follow that anymore. And some do. And it's being mindful of that and slowing down and taking that time to remember why we're here and being grateful for what we have.
That was Stony Nakota First Nations Teresa Snow on Voices of Our People. I'd like to thank today's special guests for joining us, Dakota House and Teresa Snow. Tune in next Thursday for more Voices of Our People on the Windspeaker Radio Network.